Impact Leaders, the podcast on leaders focusing on impact investment and performance with purpose, supporting the companies that are solving the world's biggest challenges. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact. And this is your host, JP Dahlman.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of Impact Leaders. In today's episode of Impact Leaders, we have Martin Rich as a guest. Hello, Martin.
Hi, welcome. JP. Thank you very much. Good to be here.
Thank you so much for being with us today, for your time, and for coming all the way across London to see us here at the headquarters of Fast Forward 2030.
No worries at all.
As a way of introduction, as you know, I always do, I like to share a little bit about our guest. So today, Martin, he's an impact investment specialist with over 20 years experience in both mainstream and social investment. He is the co-founder and executive director of Future Fit Foundation, which we're going to be talking about today. Prior to this, he spent 7 years as a sales director at Social Finance, who, by the way, are known for launching the first social impact bond back in 2010. Where he focused on developing the investment base for social impact investment and structuring products to link capital with demand. And as we know, it's one of the challenges we have bringing that capital to the companies. Before that, he worked for 13 years in international investment banking on structured debt and derivative products for JP Morgan, HSBC, and UBS. Martin has a passion for sustainable development and poverty relief. And he is a non-executive director at several organizations, such as Access Foundation. He sits on the investment committee for Panoply Foundation and the Assets and Liability Committee for the Social Investment Business, and is a member of Christian AIDS in their Lifetime Campaign Directorate. He's also a former member of the Asset Allocation Working Group for the GA Social Investment Task Force. And if all of that was not amazing enough, already, he holds a double master's in engineering from Queen's College, Cambridge.
Sounds good.
That's quite a CV, Martin.
Thank you.
Yeah. So it is our tradition. I want to just start briefly with our question, but just before our first question. But before I say that, I wanted to say to listeners that you give us feedback and we listen. And I know that people have been asking about, can we talk about a measurement of impact? So within, let's say, the theme today, and that's why we invite, one of the reasons why I invited Martin to join us is because we're going to talk perhaps about the data behind that and how we can use that data to better measure. So I hope you enjoyed this podcast episode. So the first question, Martin, is what is impact investing to you?
I'll start with a difficult question. That ought to be an easy question. But interestingly, when I first got into the impact space, so that was 2009, as you say, and I joined Social Finance Limited, the notion to most people, which is not wrong, is that impact investment is about investment. So there is financial risk and reward associated, but that there is intentional positive social or environmental impact that you're trying to achieve through that investment. And as far as a definition goes, that's fine and good. But when you ask me the question, what is impact investing? Over the journey of being at Social Finance and then into Future Fit, I began to perceive that all investment is actually impactful. So there's a subtle distinction I'm trying to make already, right up front here, is that are we talking about a definition of impact investing and achieving impact, which is a thing, or actually do we want to look at the world more broadly, which is how I approach things, which is ultimately every investment has an impact on the world. Mm-hmm. Some good, some bad. Some investments are more good and less bad. And we'll start to talk in a minute about what there's a evocative words, good and bad. But some portfolios, many portfolios, standard portfolios of listed equities or something, they will have some good impact on the world and the environment. But actually, the vast majority of their impact, I would argue, is probably not good, is detrimental, and is part of the reason that we're facing all of the many issues that you and your listeners will be very familiar with. And quite early on in my days at Social Finance, there was, back in those earlier days of the market, the view was that impact investment is an asset class.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And that was a view that was propounded by a lot of people, so it still is,
and
by some.
And there's a paper out there, I think, from JP Morgan that I used
in
my article in Forbes. Yeah.
And I never agreed with that statement. And I always said, I think impact investment is a mindset, not an asset class.
Okay.
What are you trying to achieve with your investments? Yes, a financial return for a given level of risk, absolutely. But actually, if we can open the world's eyes to understanding the impact of their investment and get them to see that there's this third dimension to investment, and start saying, what are you trying to achieve with that third dimension as well as what are you trying to achieve with your financial objectives? Suddenly, we start to join the dots as individuals, and I don't have my grant making pot, which is all about impact and, you know, 100% loss of money, and maybe some patient impact loans, 0%, you know, patient loans or something, and then I've got my pension, and then I've got my return seeking private equity portfolio, or you know, whatever you might have as an individual, rather than seeing those as individual buckets. If you view it through a three-dimensional sort of approach, actually these things all combine together. They become one thing, one portfolio, part of which is just about achieving positive impact and zero financials, some of which has an impact, I just don't know what it is today, but is trying to achieve high returns. It all becomes a blended piece. So that's a very long answer to a fairly simple question,
but I
think it sets the ground for where we're going to go.
But it raises some reflections, which, you know, we all, I think, trying to go through, and I think it's nice that you share, you know, over 10 years or so experience, you know, on how your view of the definition has evolved, you know? And I think that I can remember the date of that paper. It's like a research paper from JP Morgan.
Yeah,
I'm pretty sure.
2012.
Yeah, I think
like
it was about that time. Yeah. And I think what they were using they started from the premises of the definition of a new asset class or of an asset class, and there were quite a few characteristics. And when you read it, the way they put it, that sounds like an asset class. And I think they used an analogy with, let's say, emerging markets and how, you know, emerging markets, you know, as an asset class didn't exist before, but then, you know, as you put the variables that define an emerging market as an asset class, then it was created. Yeah. So I think that's kind of the analogy that we're using. But on the specific definition, basically what I hear is that you have the whole impact investments, they're just bad or negative impact investments and positive impact investments.
Right. And you know, and ultimately I don't care about definitions in that sense. And, you know, I'm not interested in arguing with people whether I'm right or they're right. What I'm interested in ultimately is, what is their money doing? And what is the impact of that investment? Do they understand what that is? Are they trying to align their personal values or the values of their organization or their family or whatever it might be? Are they trying to take responsibility for the impact that is happening anyway, and then thinking about that responsibility, that ownership that they have, even if it's a tiny amount, and again, taking ownership of that and saying, well, this is what I want to achieve, or that's not what I want to achieve, so I want to try and shift what my money is doing. That's what I'm really interested in, passionate about. And at the end of the day, that's what I would, you know, we'll debate with somebody is how do we improve what's happening with that capital, and how do we use capital as a driver for positive change, increasing more the positive that happens, reducing the negative that happens.
Yeah.
And how we define that or what we call it. Yeah, I don't really mind.
Yeah. It's a matter of, I think we can start talking about, you know, principles, right?
Yeah, right.
Principles living.
Yeah.
Okay. So if During all these years, you know, you have again experience, have different experience, different roles, you know, from let's say what we said mainstream to you know, social finance, and now with FutureFit Foundation. So what is kind of the biggest challenge or some of the biggest challenges that you have found that took you perhaps to, you know, founding a FutureFit Foundation?
So I think the journey really sort of started when I'd been in mainstream mainstream banking rather for 13 years, as you said, these various houses, and I had a great time. It was a very interesting career. Really learned how the financial markets work globally, and companies finance themselves, and all of that stuff. Which when I came out of university as an engineer, I had zero understanding of. So fascinating, and I wouldn't change that history. But after a while, it began to just become obvious that there was just no understanding of what we would now call the impact. Mm-hmm. You know, even no impact really existed, but it just never featured as a night, right? And again, it's not a mea culpa thing. It's not saying that the financial markets are bad. There's lots of issues with them, but you know, sometimes a lot of good that they enable. But for me, I just reached that point of having, you know, climbed a certain way up the slippery pole, and began to think, well, how do I want to carry on, you know, climbing that and getting actually further away from the clients and the business, and it's more about the internal management and the politics. And you're nodding. I think you've been there. You know exactly what I'm talking about.
Slippery pole.
That didn't appeal. And at the same time, I'd reached this point of I didn't really care whether the next corporate hedged its debt capital markets issue with me or not. You know, what impact really was that having on the world? So I began to sort of start thinking about actually how do I start using this financial knowledge and skill set for a better purpose, a better reason. I had no idea what that meant. I just, the concept was there. And that, interestingly, at the time I'd been working with the HSBC climate finance team, they were technically called, run by Nick Robbins at the time. Mm-hmm. And that was in the early days of what today we would call environmental finance, and sort of the early days of green bonds and all of that sort of stuff. And I'd become one of the main contacts on the trading floor for helping to structure some of these ideas and issues as they were coming along. So I think probably that also helped to spark this thought of how do I do more of that? And all of that was in sort of 2007, 2008. And as people will remember, there was a bit of a ripple in the markets around that time. And things sort of presented me with the opportunity, shall we say, to reinvent myself. And actually with that break, you know, I was able to actually step out and say, okay, what does it really mean to use finance in a positive way? And I just stumbled into the impact investment market. I was literally Googling, you know, using impact for or finance for good, and suddenly ran into, you know, London as this bubbling hot space of impact investment was growing. And, you know, Sir Ronald Cohen was sort of, you know, a central point of growing that, and all these other organizations were starting to pop up, and an incredibly exciting time. So my timing
it's a combination of timing, right?
Absolutely.
One of my friends calls the come to Jesus moment.
Yeah.
And we'll talk about that. So, but kind of opportunity, market opportunity.
Yeah.
And you know, Mr. Cohen still, he found it, right?
Absolutely. And, so he founded Social Finance.
And he's still in the chair. So
he's not actually in the organization anymore. He's now running the global steering group,
the GSG.
Yeah. So absolutely, right. I mean, he's still, you know, powering that market around the world. For me, coming, you know, either be good or be lucky, right? And I think at that point, I was probably just lucky with my timing. Social finance had an opening, and this was like, fantastic. I get to use my banking knowledge and skills. There were some things I had to put down. I mean, you know, derivative pricing wasn't really very useful from that point on. But understanding, you know, how finance really worked, what was important, was a valuable tool to take into that organization. But at the same time, I, you know, suddenly had this new group of amazing colleagues who were working at the real sharp end of issues that I was vaguely aware of as a hopefully reasonably, you know, well-educated, well-read individual. I know that I've lived in many ways. I don't come from a particularly wealthy background or anything, but I've lived a very, very blessed life. And, you know, I haven't known the need and poverty of not only money, but opportunity that many have. And I was always taught that, you know, my mom always used to say, you know, whatever you do, just be the best at it. If you want to be a bin man, be a bin man, but just be a great bin man. If you want to be a teacher, be a teacher, be a great teacher. If you want, whatever it is. So I always had this sort of, you know, guiding principle. And then suddenly, here I was working alongside these folks who themselves were working alongside those who'd never had these opportunities, and began to open my eyes, to youth reoffending, the reality of drug and alcohol addiction, violence against women, all of this stuff that the social enterprises and social impact bonds that we would eventually start trying to finance were seeking to work with. So it was an incredible crashing together of two completely different worlds. And again, an amazing few years working there. But for me, the journey then was, my job was to persuade people to put their money to work in these things. And of course, you know, you buy into the mission instantly, and you meet these organizations. Oh, wow, how can we not fund these? And then, of course, you walk back into the institutional investors. It's like, wow, we got these great opportunities. We're going to help all these people, and we're going to do all this amazing impact, and it's brilliant. And then, of course, you just get this stony look back. It's like, well, you're doing a great thing. And the unspoken piece was, it's a shame you're not a proper banker anymore. But well done you for doing this charitable objective. And if there's one thing that will really get my blood boiling, it's that sort of reading that response in people. Oh, you know, how dare you? You know,
that was one of the first kind of all painful challenges you faced at that time.
Totally, totally. But what that revealed to me over time was this disconnect between the financial risk and reward, the picture of the financial instrument, and the impact that it was having on the world. And yes, here I was trying to sell deliberately, intentionally positive impact investments. But the fact that the machinery that we've set up outside of the, if I may call it, the more philanthropic end of the spectrum, the high net worth, the individual, maybe some of the foundations who invest in this way, outside of that world, it's like you're trying to sell a three-dimensional cardboard box to somebody who's only got a machine that will take a sheet of paper. Right. Here I am trying to talk about, oh, we're going to work with all these young offenders, and we're going to stop them going back in on the revolving door of prison, and we're going to help them get jobs and housing and off the addiction and improve their family relationships and blah, blah, blah. We go, oh, that's lovely. That's great. Now let's tear the heart out of that, because I can't process that. I don't know what to do with that information. It's very nice. It makes me feel warm and fuzzy. But now I need to get down to the asset. What? And I get why that was the case. But then you suddenly think, oh, but this doesn't make sense. You've just torn the heart out of something. And it's not about even trading off financial risk and reward for the impact, although that may be required in some circumstances. But it was just, you're just pulling something apart and then looking at the separate pieces and trying to understand them and expecting it to make sense. But it doesn't. And so it was this slow sort of evolution of thought process. I don't, you know, there wasn't a road to Damascus light bulb moment. It was absolutely over years of these conversations that I began to realize that if we could get to a point where we could shift the thinking from this two-dimensional to this three-dimensional approach, suddenly everything fell into place. Your mainstream equity portfolio, you could understand the impact of it, good and bad. Your social impact bonds, you could plot onto the same graph. Your giving, you could plot onto the same graph. You could start to see the overall impact that you were having financially, socially, environmentally in one framework. Now we could suddenly have a sensible conversation about what are you trying to achieve? How do you optimize your portfolio across the three dimensions, not just the two? And the world has moved from a one-dimensional place, right? We used to only talk about return. Go back to the 50s, 60s, 70s. You and I are both too young to remember most of those, thankfully. And then we, you know, some very smart people, mainly at American universities, suddenly sort of said, hang on a second, return varies with risk. There's this thing called risk. We need to understand that. And suddenly, bang, you have risk reward, right? And the CAPM pricing model and all of that stuff sprung up. And now it's anathema to talk about risk without return or return without risk. So we've had that one transition. Well, why can't we make this next transition and start to understand really what's going on and begin to optimize according to that? So that when all of that came together, that was the real waking up moment. And then sort of I started, you know, banging my fist on the table saying, somebody needs to build this system. Somebody needs to build this tool, which of course is a dangerous thing to do, right? Because one day you wake up and you...
That sounded like a corporate situation, right? In a big bank.
Exactly. Somebody else needs to do this. Why isn't somebody else doing it? And then, yeah, one day you wake up and you look in the mirror and you realize that, yeah, maybe somebody does need to do it, which was a frightening moment. But the great thing was, thankfully, it was at that time that I was at a Volans event here in town. I see not more than about 200 yards from the building we're in right now. And the guy behind me in the coffee queue tapped me on the shoulder and just said, hi, my name's Jeff, who are you? And we got chatting. Turned out to be a great guy called Dr. Jeff Kendall, PhD in AI, spent 20 years in the mobile phone tech startup world, was working then at Sustainability, the sustainability consultancy, capital S, capital A, founded by John Elkington, so the father of the triple bottom line. He was sharing a similar burden, but from a different perspective, in that he was trying to show companies how to be truly sustainable, to understand their impacts, to measure them and begin to work out where they needed to be going. How could they actually become truly sustainable and indeed one might say truly impactful? And, you know, when you're trying to seek out to develop something like that, you basically need to find a fellow nutter who will join you on the journey. And literally from that one coffee, 6 months later, we'd both quit our jobs. We set up a charity to create this thing. And five, six years later, here we are, we've done it.
Excellent. And so again, what I hear on the journey is that, you know, the challenge that we are facing is, okay, how do we make this kind of, for to use the same word we used before, mainstream, and how do we make the system and the machine being able to, what is the word I'm looking for? You talked about the box, you know, to be able to manage the 3D box, right?
Exactly. Exactly.
Compute or process.
Yes.
So from and again, there is we talked another occasion. You were talking about kind of how we need to effectively change systems, right? And we need to change the whole system, which is Absolutely. A big ask.
Yeah,
it takes, you know, a lot of parts. And the way that you have tried to do is to try to create these tools, these ways, right, so that it makes it practical for companies to be able to at least operate kind of at the one company level. And then ideally then at the more systemic level.
Correct. Yes.
Absolutely.
And I think so you're right, the approaching this from a system perspective, at the end of the day, you know, you can take the view that I love the definition that the purpose of a system is what it does. And it's absolutely right that the financial system today, the financial industry, is basically set up to transfer wealth.
Mm-hmm.
And it does it incredibly well.
Yeah.
And it does it incredibly efficiently. So when we then sort of say, well, we should be using investment to restore the environment, to make society more equal, more just, the system isn't set up to do that. So we can't be surprised when it doesn't do it. A system, the purpose of a system is what it does. So actually, we do need to redesign all of these things. We need to change the system, because if we're going to change the outputs, we need to change the system. As Einstein who said, if we keep doing the sign of madness is if we keep doing the same thing and expect a different result.
But I was going to say that the system is to support the behavior of people, and that's something that I keep banging on about, which is if you are a consumer, high consumer, and you are just spending all your money and buying clothes, fast fashion, changing the car the details of the small behavior of every human. That's what the system is there to do.
Yeah.
And the companies do that for you. And then the banks fund the companies and the pensions, the banks. And that is the system.
And the system is there ultimately to feed your needs.
Yes.
People
sometimes, I don't think that they can realize.
I think the vast majority of people don't realize that they're not taught or encouraged at any point to actually open their eyes and look up. It's always the way that people... everybody wants the housing market to be more affordable, except for their house. They don't want their house value to drop because that's their store of wealth. Everybody thinks we should have a better NHS or a better, police system or whatever it might be, but they don't want to pay the extra taxes. So it's always you or they who should change within the system, but partly because people just don't take the time to stop and realize so often the interconnectedness of everything. And so the commercial system that we've created is here to sate our desires, some of which are practical and necessary, food and basic clothing, but then always the new phone, the new car, the fast fashion, keep changing, can't wear the same thing twice, whatever it might be.
At least in this part of the blessed part of the world, by the way,
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. But the point is then that because you're only seeing it in isolation, we're then not looking at that negative impact, the negative externalities, as we could call them. All of these impacts that we're having on the rest of the world by living this way. So the conditions down in the supply chains, where the raw materials are coming from, the impact on the planet of the chemicals, the plastic, the carbon, all of these things, which people will be more and more familiar with. We don't look at any of that. We don't price any of that. We don't think about any of that. So while we're living in these isolated bubbles and being fed this constant marketing need to improve, you've only got the iPhone X, you need the iPhone XS, or other phones are available. We're just caught in that rather than actually saying, well, if we step out of the system for a second and we say, what is the purpose? Or what should the purpose of the system be? Shouldn't the purpose of the system be to allow humanity and indeed all life on earth to flourish? What would it look like if we redesigned the system such that that were the case? Everybody could live the life that they flourished in, where the products and services that we provided were restorative and replenitive, if that's a word, to the environment, where supply chains weren't about just treating people like machine, but actually treated them like human beings, where creativity, purpose, all of these types of things could be found in how we live, in what we do, and how we define ourselves. then you start to think, you know, we'd be moving in something more like the right direction. Mm-hmm. And I'm not, you know, talking about recreating Eden or Nirvana, but just a world in which everybody can flourish and prosper. And there will almost inevitably still be rich and poor and haves and have nots. But I think we would be creating a much more level playing field, and one where those impacts were seen and understood, and more effort would then be made to continuously start to improve, to level or make more equal that for everybody.
Yes. So all of that is bringing me very nicely to talk and ask you a little bit more about your company, which, by the way, is a, you mentioned it before, it's a charity.
Yes, it has yes.
The name Foundation, so it's a effectively a non-for-profit.
Yeah.
And it has, you know, several parts to it. And I take the advantage to the opportunity to say, so it's futurefeedbusiness.org. That's the website.
Yep, that's the website.
So it's a new website coming up soon. So everyone listening,
middle of April, check out the new website.
Yep. So that's about the time that you're going to be listening to this podcast. So and you mentioned there, you mentioned the word flourish, right? Because it says your vision is a future in which everyone has the opportunity to flourish.
Yes.
Your mission is to encourage and enable, you know, such a change.
Yep.
You know, that we've been talking about. But can you tell us, you know, a little bit more about it? So how do you do it?
Yeah. So absolutely, I mean, everything I've been talking about, you know, leads to this point of the vision and how we get there. However, when you get two business guys coming together to create this, we want to create practical tools. We're not interested in writing big glossy reports that people read and nod and then sit on the shelf and don't do anything. And I think too often, unfortunately, you know, there are lots of great initiatives that happen that pull in lots of high profile people and businesses, and at the end of it you get a report which might have five or six principles or steps or things to do, and you know, people read it and say, well, what do I now do? I'm an engineer by training. I'm interested in building solutions, and therefore showing people what to do. That means we cut through the nonsense. And we get down to, okay, here's the vision. I've talked about the flourishing. I've talked about all these great visions and stuff. Fantastic. Now, what do I actually do? So the tools that we create as Future Fit Foundation are about showing people, showing organizations how to actually now get to this point. As we said, we work on a systems perspective. So everything that we've built is built on a system science framework. And the first system that we've then chosen, or subsystem we've chosen to engage with, is business, because we think business has such a massive opportunity. However, the tool and the way we've gone about building this actually works just as well for towns and cities, for households, for countries, for any type of system. And we will produce benchmarks in due course that will actually cover all of those pieces. So how do we create a future fit society? We have individuals living in a future fit household commuting from their future fit town to a future fit business where they work. You get the idea.
Yeah.
So the framework that we've built on is a thing called the Framework for Strategic Sustainable Development, which 99.9% of your listeners will never have heard of. We'd never heard of it even when we started this journey.
So say again,
the Framework for Strategic Sustainable Development. It comes from Sweden. It's 25 plus years old, and it's a systems-based definition of what a truly sustainable society living on a truly sustainable planet looks like. It's been peer-reviewed and evolved over time. It's academically rigorous, spot-on, correct, all the rest of it.
But it's being applied there, hence?
Well, that's the problem.
Okay.
It's very academic. It's very esoteric. And any business individual would read it, would read the principles, would nod and agree, but you're slightly back in the "it's a nice report, what do I do with it" scenario. So what we did was, when we discovered this framework and we realized it was exactly the thing we needed to build on. So we had this great vision of showing companies what to do and investors putting their money in, but we didn't have a clue how to build it. We found this framework. It was introduced to us by a mutual friend, And we suddenly realized, wow, this is the concrete that we need to put in the foundations, which we can then build upon. And what we did was translate those principles into actions for companies. We realized that these system principles and boundaries effectively created, if you like, an environmental and social break-even point. Mm-hmm. And that was what gave us this magical line in the sand, that we could start to say anything on the wrong side of that line is damaging planet and society, is, if you like, bad, to get back to that earlier comment. Yes. Anything that is restoring, reinforcing those boundaries, helping others to get to that point, reversing past damage, is positive, is good, is impactful. And no other framework that was out there that we've yet seen had such a line in the sand. But by creating that line, what you suddenly give companies, or whichever system it is that you're looking at, businesses for us for now, is you give them a target to aim for. For the first time, you say that is the minimum standard that you actually need to get to. So for the first 3 years of our life, what we did was map a generic company against these principles and try and come up with a holistic set of actions that meant that you were not breaching any of those principles. And that's what form our break-even goals. There are 23 of them as it happens. So they're things like zero greenhouse gas emissions from your products, the same from your operations. Everybody must be paid a living wage, the right tax paid at the right place at the right time. It's amazing how many companies don't like that one quite so much. But holistically, those goals define those boundary conditions. And we went through multiple rounds of public consultation. We worked with experts around the world. We've done two full releases of the benchmark, again, in mid-April, version 2.1. So sort of our 2.5 third release will come out. So we've evolved this using feedback from companies and investors and so all these experts we've worked with. So we're reasonably comfortable now that those goals together define that line in the sand. And what our tool provides is detailed guidance then on each of those underlying goals as to what does it actually mean. So the goal itself is written in very simple language like I just described. Anybody with no detailed information can get the concept. What it then means for your business, what are your boundaries of whole accountability, mutual accountability, or indeed no accountability, what's outside your bounds of responsibility. We define all of that. We define what does it mean to reach the level of future fitness. And on a 0 to 100% scale, measure where you are today. So this then becomes not a reporting exercise, not a tick box questionnaire, but a management tool to understand where are you today versus the minimum standard that you need to reach across all of these different aspects. And only when you get to 100% on each of those goals can you say you are a truly future fit organization. The flip side of that coin, the positive side then, is what we call our positive pursuits. Mm-hmm. And we equally there define a series of categories, 24 of them, that define all of the things that you can do to now reinforce those boundary conditions. So the categories of actions that are restoring the environment, making society more just or financially inclusive. Because there are lots of good things that somebody could do, but not all of those are actually reinforcing the boundary condition, right? So, you know, helping the wealthy to feel better about themselves by wearing nicer clothing. Well, I'm not saying that's inherently a bad thing, but it's not something that is making the world more financially inclusive or socially just. So we wouldn't give you any future fit impact brownie points for doing that.
Yeah.
But these categories enable, again, companies to talk consistently and thus comparably about the positive things that they are doing for society and the world in the context of what is the negative that they are causing. And what's so nice about this framing is if you now look at it from the perspective of saying, okay, what would it mean for my business whatever industry I'm in, to only be operating in this positive space? What would it mean for my business to flourish because every single dollar I earn is actually reinforcing doing good for the planet and society? Just dream for a second. What would that look like? What is your purpose? And every company has a purpose these days. But what does it mean for that purpose to be worked out in practical terms? What would that look like? And what would it look like to do that with none of those negative externalities? How could you achieve that with zero waste, by paying everybody correctly, by zero carbon emissions? Could you paint a picture of your organization like that in, say, 20, 25 years' time? Wow. What does your conversation with your CFO and your CEO, your CSO, if you have one, sustainability officer, imagine now the conversation that's going on in that room. That's no longer somebody saying, can I have $50,000 to put LED lights in my factories? It's not a bad thing to do, but that conversation versus, we are going to transform our business into being one that is truly sustainable, that's de-risked the supply chain, that's de-risked ourselves from carbon tax being introduced in the future, that has de-risked ourselves from the reputation risk to our staff, to our customers, to show the impact that we are positively having through our products and services, to be thinking about how do you respond to the ever-changing and ever-accelerating technological and other changes that are going on, to have removed as is physically possible those risks from your business, and to be transforming yourself into this truly sustainable organization. If that's the conversation that we are empowering boards to have, then we are going to really trigger some dramatic change. And the framework doesn't tell you how to get there. It doesn't tell you what you look like, but it gives you those conditions. It gives you the framework to paint that picture and then say, okay, if that's where we want to be in 20 years' time, where are we today? Okay, now how do we get there? What are the easy wins? What are the things that we know how to do, but we've got to re-engineer our business to get to? And then what are the pieces that today we're just going, I have no idea how I'm going to achieve that?
Okay, so just to clarify a couple of points. So it is not it's just a self-assessment where you just rank yourself on a 0 to 100 on each one of the areas, right? Just to be very, maybe more.
So the model is designed as self-assess, but third-party assure.
Okay.
So we've tried.
Yeah, and we will talk about assurance in I think, a bit more as well.
I think we should.
And it's quantifiable as well, right?
So absolutely.
So you can quantify kind of costs associated, and it actually can be transferred to like financial statements impact.
That's, at the end of the day, this is about embedding sustainability into the core of your business. Right. This isn't about creating a fancy CSR report that you then staple to your annual report and call it an integrated report. This is about how do you integrate sustainability into every aspect of your job and your business. So absolutely, that then feeds into the core business expense and hopefully growing income. So what we can't do from the outside is say to a business, if you do this goal, it will increase your ROI by X. That will totally vary business by business. Mm-hmm. And clearly, as a company goes through that transformation, it needs to also justify the financial business case. However, if you paint that picture of yourself in the future and you find that that business model then just won't stand up financially, you've got a problem. Either you can only exist as a non-sustainable business, slightly ironic statement in itself. So you are purposefully stepping out into the future knowing that you are bad for planet or society.
Yeah.
Or you say, okay, our vision of the future isn't quite yet right. How do we adjust what that's doing to get to a point where it is financially viable? And now what is the linkage between those pieces? So I'm really excited for at some point in the future when we get to a point where companies have been tracking this FutureFit data for a period of time, and we can start to look at the correlations and possibly causations then of each of the individual goals against credit spreads or share price performance or whatever it might be. Because that, of course, is always the question people ask, right?
Yeah.
You know, how's this going to impact? We don't know today. And I get slightly frustrated in a way when people ask that question, because we simply don't have the right data to be able to meaningfully answer that. There's an increasing number of studies that are saying, you know, ESG-related funds at least perform as well as non-ESG integrated funds. And I'm delighted that that evidence appears to be there, because that, you know, helps bolster the case for what I'm doing. But the reality of the data that's being used is it's very poor underlying company data. It's very loose definitions of what we mean of ESG integration from one fund to another. There really isn't good, solid data yet that helps us to draw those correlations. And that's something that I think will flow out at the back of what we're doing. It's not the main reason we're doing this by any means, but I think it's a benefit, because as we start to show, hopefully, where there is positive correlation, that's an additional driver for businesses and investors to encourage that behavior. And if it's moving us in the right direction and it's increasing financial performance, who's not going to do that?
So the challenge as a C-suite level CEO and as a board member of any, you know, major organization and any organization, how do I go about it? And I think what you're saying is that you're providing that framework and that tool so that they have something to start with.
Exactly.
There's some companies that have been doing it. I think we mentioned in one of the episodes previously, I think it was the Dong Energy.
Yes, now Ørsted.
Yeah. So, you know.
Who we work with. Yeah.
So, fascinating. And I was thinking, okay, how did they do it? I was thinking, if I am, you know, a board member or a managing director of this company, what great vision, you know, to be
Absolutely.
Able to transform your company from one. It's funny because you want to say from one business to another, but no, the business is energy.
Mm.
If they just, you know, change that they the way that they deliver that.
Right.
But again, I don't know if they used you to do that.
They didn't, just to make it clear.
But again, you know,
they are using us
it's a lot harder,
now.
Yeah, but it's a lot harder for people to actually try to benchmark and copy them if they don't know how they do it and it's not publicly available. Which again, just to reinforce, and we'll talk a little bit more about this as well. Your model is that this is all publicly available.
Absolutely.
For anyone
Absolutely.
And everyone to use. This is an IP that you are creating that is, you know, for society to use.
Yes.
Right?
Everything that we produce is published under a Creative Commons free license. Yeah. So at the end of the day, this is not about trying to create the latest black box and say, we've got the secret and we're not going to tell you. We have to have this out there, partly because we believe it's so important. Yeah. If you're trying to get scale adoption these days, open source is the way that works. And actually that speaks into Jeff, my co-founder's experience of seeing the mobile phone tech world open up. And we also want it to be open so that people can challenge.
Mm.
They can see all the inner workings. They can see the calculations. And if there's something wrong or we've missed something, then it's been co-created. Come and tell us. Say, well, what about this? You forgot that. You've missed this. That doesn't make sense. Brilliant. If you find something fantastic, come and tell us, because then we can change it. We can make it better and we can keep improving it. So absolutely, that's a critical element for us.
Okay, excellent. And again, let's reinforce the why. And the why is, you know, because, you know, as you put it on your side as well, is, you know, the global economy is failing.
Yes.
Society. And we have to work together. Right.
Totally.
To actually come up with a solution and get back on track.
And this is the pragmatic aspect coming out, is we have enormous challenges. People are nowhere near scared enough about climate change, for example. We know the societal pressures. You know, you only need to look at the global news every day. But if we just turn around to people and say, right, stop doing everything tomorrow, we are going to be listened to not in the slightest. If we said to everybody, stop flying tomorrow, stop driving, stop burning, it's just not going to happen, even if it should. What we're trying to do is change the system around people as quickly as we can, not quickly enough, but at least as quickly as we can, so that actually we reimagine what making journeys looks like, what connecting with family and friends look like. We take away this ridiculous notion that you can buy a sustainable t-shirt or the unsustainable t-shirt. Why can you buy an unsustainable t-shirt? Doesn't actually make sense if you take this step back for a second. Of course, you know, somebody's probably just shouted the recording, well, because it's cheaper. And they're right. Mm. But of course, then therein is the nub of the problem, right? Mm. We've created this global socioeconomic system where the unsustainable t-shirt is available because we don't price in the cost to the environment. We don't price in the labor that's stuck in a sweatshop somewhere, etc.
And it's still okay to invest, you know, money on those companies.
Right.
Yeah.
So how do we, you know, break out of that, but change the system around people so that they can continue to travel, but probably in a different way, maybe at a different price point, maybe in a...
Yes, and we talked, I mean, this is another part we can talk about, but I want to go maybe now to a specific example so that people can really see, you know, how you're planning with one of your clients. But we were talking about the aviation industry on a separate conversation, right? And how the aviation industry needs to work together as an industry to come up with solutions so that people can actually keep flying because they're not going to stop flying,
right?
But with completely different airplanes, different engines, etc. And are we doing that as a system, right?
Exactly.
I think we can leave that one for maybe podcast number two. If you can share with us an example of, you know, one of your clients and perhaps one of your partners. I know that you mentioned before about Novo Nordisk.
Mm.
So maybe can you tell us a little bit about that and what the results are, or anything particular that can help people put it, you know, picture it a little bit better?
Absolutely. So Novo Nordisk are one of our development council members. Our development council is a group of leading companies and investors who are adopting the benchmark in different ways, are practically using it. But then importantly, development is the key word. They're then trying to feedback that knowledge and learning to us so that we can embed that in the benchmark and hence continually evolve and improve the guidance that we're putting out. Novo Nordisk is, for those who don't know, a global pharmaceutical business. They make about 50% of the world's insulin. They're a Danish-based organization. Actually very sustainable, and in their DNA, their founding documents, they have a thing called the Novo Nordisk Way. So they were founded with very social principles. So that is in the DNA of the business, which helps to a degree. But they are the first company to have gone through a full benchmarking exercise. So they have gone through all 23 of the benchmark goals. They've got the data. They've gone and found the data internally. Some they had, a lot they had to go and find. Some they don't yet have. They're trying to figure out how to get that data. They worked with DMVGL, the consultant, went in to help, and they met with a whole load of people internally, just had sort of a series of, Cora Olson, the lady who led the work internally, describes it as speed dating. Basically set the consultants up with all of these different colleagues and said, right, just talk to them. And then once they'd finished doing all of the calculations, back to the assurance point, they got Grant Thornton, another of our development council members, to come in and assure data. And the framework has been designed to be assurable to ISAE 3000 standards, which I'm sure you're very familiar with, JP. Just in case you're not, ISAE 3000 is the global standard for non-financial data. So if IFRS is the standard for financial data, ISAE 3000 is the equivalent for non-financial data. So any audit company is capable of assuring or indeed even auditing data to that standard. Right now, we work to a standard of assurance, not full audit. The world is not quite ready to get to that point. Maybe one day. No reason why we couldn't. But today, to assure that data. So again, Novo Nordisk got their data then independently assured. They've previewed the results. We're hopeful that they will publish those results very, very soon. So they will be the first multinational listed company to be able to show the world a full set of benchmark results. As I did a UN Global Compact presentation with Novo Nordisk just this very afternoon. So I'm not speaking out of school here in terms of what the results look like, but unsurprisingly, you know, it's a spread, a reasonably easy, even spread, pleasingly for them, slightly tilted towards the good end. So there's a good number of goals that they're in the 75 to 100% progress range. There's a good handful of goals that they're in the middle. And there's a good chunk of the goals where they're in their own scores of red, 0 to 25. They either don't know the data and they're not sure, or they've just not addressed these issues. But the important comment that Cora would make is, but now we know.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, they as an organization are delighted to be open about this. Celebrate the good. All of these things, we're doing well. There's a few small gaps and we're beginning to think about how do we close those. But there's these other things where it's like, wow, okay, yeah, these are big issues. We got to deal with these. But at least we know. And now we can start to plan. And that changes the whole conversation internally about R&D and about where you invest and how you grow the organization. So how do we now as an organization start to think about how we address these issues? But because we know where we are, we know what the gap is, we know what the destination looks like, we can begin to tackle these issues.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. So I'm assuming that until we see the report, we're not going to be able to see specifics, you know, around
right, some but of it. But they will, yeah. They will hopefully be, as I say, will be along very, very soon.
And so perhaps we meet with them and we interview them.
I think they would love to do that. I'm sure we can make that happen.
And see how they found the whole process, right, from the inside out. The only thing I can think of is, you know, that they have to foresee people meditating more and not needing as much medicine. I don't know. I'm just trying to think, like, how do you see the model changing, you know? But pharma is something that people, one of my partners doesn't like it when I generalize, but, you know, pharma is not seen as one of the most positive, impactful, but as a much needed sector and business, but you know, the people have different views.
Absolutely.
So I'll be very, very intrigued to
but
see.
What you know, this comes back to this whole thing of purpose again, right? Is the purpose of Novo Nordisk to sell more tablets, to sell more drugs, right? Or is their purpose to solve obesity, diabetes? And if they were successful in doing that, do they go out of business or do they actually find another problem to solve? I happen to think, and you know, ask them yourself, but I think I know the answer to that. I know which side of that coin they're on. Their purpose is to improve people's lives by solving these issues, by tackling these illnesses. And if they were tomorrow to suddenly cure diabetes somehow, I know they would be not going, oh no, now we're out of business. They'd be going, fantastic, we've solved that problem. What's the next one?
They would have made quite a handsome amount of money so they can invest in the next challenge.
Yeah. Although, well, some would argue, actually, they've just lost a whole load of money because now they're not selling X amounts of tablets every year, right? Well, but
from a traditional valuation perspective.
Right. Yeah. But that takes us back to this idea of what is the purpose of the company? Is the purpose of your company to sell more widgets, to sell more stuff? Well, we know where that's going to take us, and it's not a good end solution. Or actually, is it about tackling these problems? And how does one go about doing that? Well, I think these are so exciting conversations.
Yeah, fascinating. Sorry, if you could see my face, you know, it's just my eyes are going everywhere. Yeah, it's fascinating. Thinking you should get a prize, you should get, you know,
I think those guys should get a prize. They're the ones who've done the hard work here.
Yeah, no, I'm sorry. No, not yet. Sorry, I said that when I meant I didn't finish the phrase. That's because if you manage to basically get yourself out of business by doing so well that you solve such a huge problem like diabetes, then you should get huge financial prize from the governments around the world.
Right.
You know, so that then, that's your exit. Yeah. So I'm thinking valuation. I'm thinking exit value.
I mean,
could
you imagine if we changed the world where the exit wasn't a stock listing? It was the prize for solving the issue that your purpose was all about.
And that's
that'd be a different world.
I never thought about that. You know, why my eye was going I was just doing some kind of LBOs modeling, refreshing training the other day, and I was thinking And again, private equity, right? And how they look at, you know, how to generate revenue and how to generate value. And again, if that's the model, we'll keep trying to do businesses that we don't care how much what they do and as they generate growth, right?
Yeah.
So that I can have that exit.
Absolutely.
And valuation and that, you know, 7X.
Yeah.
So that 7X will be paid for by the system.
By solving the problems rather than just...
interesting.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't expect we'd end up there. That's cool.
Yeah, but that's it. You say we just have a conversation. There you go. You know, we came up with something new. So you also have partners. Novo Nordisk is a partner.
Absolutely.
And I see now. And then you have, you're working also with somebody that actually recommend us to talk to you, which is Deepola Hermes, Hermes Investment Management, which we did the episode with
Andrew Parry. Yes.
Before. So, and he recommended that we talk to you. So, but we are working with them also in their portfolio and the way that they approach things.
Absolutely. So again, the investor piece here is critical, but ultimately it's a lever for change, right? allocating capital per se doesn't change anything. It's a facilitator.
Yeah.
But if we are to achieve the future fit society, the vision that we have in this context of business, right, it's the businesses that need to change what they're doing and how they're doing it. But capital is an incredibly important driver, potential driver for that change. So back to my original vision when co-founding Future Fit was this idea that we could show investors what the impact of their portfolio was so that they could then make informed decisions about how to change that.
Identifying and measuring impact in a way that people are after.
Right. And when we talk to investors and Hermes and others is what they want to hear and understand is a forward-looking story of what our company is doing to address these, to use the expression ESG issues. What is the transformational forward-looking journey that the company is on? One of the most eye-opening conversations we've had in the journey of Future Fit, last year we had all our development council members together in the room. And it was great because we had corporates and investors in the same room. It's amazing how often that doesn't happen. Mm. You know, people are designing all of these different tools and systems, but they never actually put the two sides together in a room. One side just talks about what the other should do. And we had them in the room. We said to the investors, we said, what is it that you actually want to know? And they said, we want to look forward. We want to understand the journey companies are on. What are their challenges? What are they doing about them? What are the ESG things that they are doing? Yes, we want to understand the footprint. Yes, we want to know what they've done over the last year. But actually, we're far more interested in looking forward. And where are they going? How are they transforming? And what issues are they taking seriously? That's what we want to know. And we said to the companies, what's the story that you want to tell? And they said that, what he just said. And we're sat there going, where's the problem here? We've almost now built this ecosystem of ratings and reporting tools and all this other stuff that was built with the intention of drawing companies and investors together. Yeah. Around sustainability. Yeah. But actually, somehow it's ended up dividing them. It's built a mountain between them. So now people are filling in questionnaires that don't help them. The companies don't like filling it in because it takes them hours and costs them a fortune and doesn't tell them anything useful. Investors ignore it because it doesn't tell them anything useful.
It's becoming obsolete.
Right. And then you put the two of them together and they say, well, yeah, we want to say the same, we want to say and hear the same thing.
And then you cannot blame the research analysts because they're just doing and writing on what we already defined as the framework. So,
yeah. Right. Yeah. So the beauty of what Future Fit gives them is this forward-looking piece. So the various teams at Hermes are a total pleasure to work with. On the investment management side, we're starting to hone a tool that enables any investor to get a proxy future fit view of a company from the outside. So recognizing that the data today doesn't exist, you know, Novo Nordisk is the one company with data, but one down, 999,000 to go, right? But how could you start based on what data is available and what companies are saying already? You can start to paint a future fit view. So we're creating a tool that enables that to be done quickly and efficiently as a starting
companies
point.
That they already have in their portfolio.
Exactly right.
They can put it together as a portfolio. Okay.
And then they can start to go to the companies and say, hey, this is what you look like from the outside. We think you might find this framework useful to engage with. Do you want to start using it or at least tell us some more of, you know, help us fill in some of the gaps? And then actually on the engagement side of the business, the Hermes EOS side, we're working there with the team. We've reviewed their engagement process and strategy, which is an extremely well-developed and good one. You know, so it's one of the market-leading ones, certainly, that I've seen. But then reviewing that with them to align it with the benchmark. But importantly now, looking at how do we give them a framing to set targets for engagement? How do you now use the framework to set meaningful targets in the context of overall future fitness for an organization? And then how can they measure their success against that? Again, we're developing an answer to that. I think we know what that will look like. So we'll work that through with them. And then the great thing with all of these partners is all of the tools that we create through this, we make available to the FutureFit community that we're now growing.
Okay, so help me out here for context and hopefully it'll help the listeners as well. And then for background, if you haven't listened to any episodes before, please listen to Andrew Parry's episode with Hermes because he explains a lot of the things that they do. But also in terms of the value. So they manage over $30 billion of assets, hundreds of millions specifically to impact investment. But on the engagement services, which again, not a lot of people know as much about, they don't know how all the good that can do, they actually engage with large number, in terms of numbers, billions again.
It's about 450 billion or something.
But now that I'm thinking about it, so if I, on my engagement services, I'm using a future feed framework, then it should be a lot easier for anyone wanting to do impact investment to then focus on those assets. Because right now, what people are saying is that, well, I can only invest a couple of hundred million here because that's the only ones that I can cope with. And these are the only 30 public stocks that we came up with the framework to decide that they are impact, pure impact, and no greenwashing.
Where do you as an individual then want to put your money?
Yeah.
Right. So is it you're only interested in more narrowly defined impact category where there's that intentional impact piece? Great. Nothing wrong with that at all. Or actually, do you want to also be thinking about which are the companies who are beginning to go on these transformational journeys and actually be supporting them as well? So that's when absolutely you get into this engagement space. Yeah. And so it's not about divesting of everything, but actually how do we encourage those companies to transform? What's the carrot and the stick that encourages them to move in that direction?
Fantastic. Brilliant. So I hope that kind of is a first good point for the listeners again, you know, to cover, you know, about identifying and measuring impact. I think I personally go a bit more out of it as well in the conversation because it makes me realize the potential that it has to increase the amount of equities or assets where we can deploy capital.
Yes.
It makes me, again, reinforces what I personally have experienced, which is investors want to understand which ones are the impact companies. And at the same time, the impact companies want to know which ones are the investors and they want to understand how they kind of talk to each other, which is kind of common denominator.
Yeah.
It becomes quite handy.
Absolutely.
So, and then on top of all of that is kind of an assured data that can be auditable, which is another challenge that in other conversations I have heard. So,
for sure.
Brilliant. Thank you so much for that. So that's all the today. And now we talk about the future.
Mm-hmm.
A little bit about building on your vision. So it took you, let's say, 5 years, a bit more to get here.
Yes.
Which, congratulations, by all means, that you have great traction as a minimum, I would say. And already you can see the results. So congratulations and thank you. But we don't have that much time. I'm not an optimist, but at the same time, I do feel the pressure, the time that we have to push all of these forward. So how do you see things happening, in the next 5 to 10 years?
Absolutely. So the ambition of the organization within that time frame is that every major company is using FutureFit as a framework to guide its evolution, and that every investor is using FutureFit data to inform their investment decisions. That's the grand vision. Obviously, that's a huge thing we're aiming for. The critical piece for us now is building a global community of users. We've built the tool. It's pretty good, if I can say that. It can always and will always evolve and improve. No tool like this is ever going to be perfect. And if we continue to sit in an ivory tower trying to create a perfect tool, then we'll miss the window of opportunity that we have. So what we're now seeking to do is build, as I say, this community in a number of different ways. And we've identified different sort of groups of individuals and organizations that we're looking to draw in. And over time, and over the course of this year in particular, now they will start to be launched and we start to draw them together. So there's a couple of important pieces of sort of groundwork, if you like. We have our development council that we're growing at the moment. So that's this invitation-only group of leading organizations where we are working with them to really understand the impact of the benchmark on their business and how does it work out in reality. So they're really helping to drive us forward. But we need mass adoption, right? If we're going to change the world, we need tens of thousands of organizations. So how do we get there? So the first two sets of programs that we're launching, one we've launched, one we're about to, we are not a consultancy. We're not an advisory firm. We're a nonprofit. We don't want to be a consultancy. We don't want to be conflicted because we're advising on our own framework. Nor do we want to compete with the market. We want to empower the market. We want to give them another tool to use. So we've launched what we call our accredited partner and certified professional program. So we have training material. There'll be a video that people can go and watch to do some self-learning, read all of the documentation, and then take an online proficiency test to show that they've really understood the DNA of the benchmark and what it's trying to achieve and the various goals. It's quite a tough test, but if they pass, they can become a certified professional or as an organization, an accredited partner that certified professionals will work for. We've got something in the region about 50 individuals and organizations currently at various stages of going through that process. But the idea through that is that we create a global network of advisors who are there ready, willing, and able to help companies who discover the framework and say, well, this looks kind of cool. We want to engage. The moment they ring Future Fit Foundation and say, well, one of you guys come in and help us. And we have to say, no, we haven't got the bandwidth. And that's not the idea. But we are going to have this and have this growing community of folks who do understand and can come and show you how to make it work. So that's in process. We have folks in the UK, across Europe, in Japan, China, New Zealand, Australia, South America, North America, and Canada. So already that network's beginning to grow.
So just to clarify, so this can be individuals doing
yes.
it?
Yeah. Yeah.
Myself?
Absolutely.
Organizations? So do you have any specific organization that we can mention that is already working with you?
There's a range of them coming. What I would say, to be fair to all of them, is look on our new website when that launches, and we will actually have the accredited partners yeah. shown on the website. So again, the idea is that a company who comes across this for the first time can say, oh, there's a local yeah. partner I yeah. can ring up and ask
where I was
about.
Coming also from was around capabilities, you know, I just thinking numbers, and because if I'm a large organization, who can come in?
Exactly. And so we have, again, a range of organizations, some very small, you know, sort of one-man shops to mid-sized organizations. And obviously, you know, at the end of the day, our hope is that one day some of the obvious global yeah. big names will also come on board with this. And we're talking to a couple of them, so hopefully that will happen. So that's the sort of the advisory part. With the new website, we will be launching what we're calling our Changemaker program. So that is for individuals. Now, for that, there's no test, there's no hurdle, a very small annual membership fee. But the aim of that is that they will get access to our online community and forums where they can come and start to learn about the framework. But importantly, start to develop the business case to take it to their senior management and gain adoption within their business. So Changemakers,
inside,
exactly. You know, these are our stealth insiders. So, and we hope there will be students and academics, but also, if you like, entrepreneurs, yeah. great word, who will be thinking, wow, I really want to get my business moving in this direction. I really want to get my investment firm moving in this direction, but you know, I'm not the chief exec. I don't have the decision. So how can I build the business case? Well, the answer is talk to the others in the space who are doing this. Start to get that community growing. And all of that then points towards us launching towards the end of the year what we're calling our Pioneer Program. And that is the global adoption program for companies and investment firms who are committing to become future fit, who are prepared to take a public declaration saying, I am going to make my business future fit over a long period of time, for sure, but we're going to get there. We're going to make public commitments to goals and showing our progress towards those, setting targets in line with future fitness, making that progress and beginning to transform our business. So obviously what we want to then see is a growing universe of pioneer companies that say, yeah, we're on that journey. Change makers who are driving that, the certified professionals and accredited partners then who are helping when necessary on that journey. That then creates an ecosystem around the world of people using this open source tool to transform their businesses, to encourage flows of capital, to change the way they're doing things, to encourage more to come in and to grow that. We will then have regional chapters and national chapters. We've already soft launched communities in Denmark and Canada. And obviously, you know, here in the UK, we want to replicate more of that around the world. Back to your comment earlier on airlines, we want to start creating working groups around future fit industry. So the goals don't change, but obviously the challenges do. So what does future fit fashion look like? Future fit fast fashion. What does future fit pharmaceutical look like? To continue the alliteration, what does future fit flying look like? Future fit automotive, whatever it might be, getting all of these different industries then beginning to come together on a pre-competitive basis, saying these are the challenges that we face as an industry. These goals we can tackle, these ones we can't. How do we do that? What can we learn from other industries? And so if we can create this vibrant community, physical and virtual, where this information is shared and cross-learned, then I think the future for the benchmark is amazing as we continue to grow it and to increase the knowledge. Our challenge then as the foundation will be to sort of cream off the knowledge from multiple conversations happening around the world in different sectors and in different languages, and trying to capture that, put it back into the benchmark so we can again evolve that understanding of the community. So the future for us is growing that community and getting the benchmark being used, because otherwise we've created a great tool that was irrelevant because nobody used it. So that would be a shame.
You have to join the movement.
Please do. So your listeners, you know, go to our website, take a look and get on board. Yeah.
I was thinking as you were speaking, so not to detract, I'm hoping to have them on another episode, but you know, that's a B Corp, you know.
Yeah. We know them well.
Yeah, so they work on the way that companies operate and how they're set up, you know, to do what they do. So it's a base, and then I can see you now, guys, as a, almost on top of that, but beyond in terms of all the ramifications on the operations,
right,
strategy.
So, and
I don't mean to compare, but I think it's complementary.
It is, and look, it's a great question. A lot of, you know, all the time people say to us, well, you know, how do you fit in with X, Y, Z, absolutely. And it's like, no, we don't need another B Corp. We've already got B Corp. We don't need another one, and we're not another one. Yeah. I see a number of our a number of our development council members are actually B Corps anyway. So Eileen Fisher is a B Corp. The Body Shop, now part of Natura. Natura & Co. Is one of the biggest B Corps. And absolutely, there's complementarity. The simplest way we tend to describe it is to say future fit is the ultimate destination that any business needs to get to. B Corp can be a fantastic vehicle to help you get to that destination. But don't become a B Corp and then just stop. You're 80 out of 200. It's like, oh, I've got my B certification. Fantastic. If that's the right route for you to go down as a business, brilliant. We'd absolutely encourage that. But don't get to that certification and stop. Say, right, what else do I need to do to get to being future fit?
Okay.
So absolutely, they complement each other.
So we're talking about all of these different points. I was thinking, so you are an organization. To be able to do all this, you need funding.
Yes.
you are a business.
It's true.
You know, non-for-profit business.
Yep.
And so I can see now that you will have some people taking, so your business model, basically, I was thinking about, so if we can share for other people that get inspiration from you.
Absolutely.
So you have a small subscription from some people. You have some partners. I'm assuming they're going to be paying different.
So the model, during the development period, we've been mainly grant funded.
And if you don't mind me asking, to celebrate them, would you mind sharing the name of your
funders? I'd love to.
Because I know that you received a couple of millions recently, so...
sadly not couples, but yeah. So the earliest big funder we had from the UK here was Friends Provident Foundation. So big thank you to them, because we wouldn't even got to the second stages without them. Now in this growth phase, it's three foundations: Joseph Rowntree Charitable Trust, Shell Foundation, and a Swiss-based group called Partners for a New Economy. We love them all. They're amazing.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm just the, you know, without their vision and support, and actually trying to raise grant funding for something that is big picture as we are, is actually really quite hard. I mean, any grant
funding is hard, but trying to
what's the counterfactual? What would the world be without future fit? You know, I can't ever paint that picture. But those folks have stepped up for us, and it's amazing. We're genuinely very grateful. But absolutely, our ambition is to get off grant funding, because it is uncertain and we can't plan for the long-term future on that alone. So the model is very simple. All of the various groups that I described before, to be part of the community, there will be a small annual subscription. So the IP, the benchmark, will always be free, will always be open source for anybody. So you can take it, you can use it, not pay us a cent. That's fine. What we hope is that you would want to be part of the community. You'd want to share, you'd want to give back a little bit through using that and to learn and all the rest of it. So if you want to do that and be part of the community, then there will be a modest annual membership fee. We don't want the money ever to be a hurdle. We want it to be, if you like, an incentive so that you want to be part of that group.
And commitment.
Commitment, exactly. And then the idea is that if we can get enough people within the membership, then we can fund ourselves on an ongoing basis. We can continue to grow the team. We never want to be massive. We'd love to have a global presence, but again, that doesn't mean that we have to have, you know, thousands of people working for us. We won't, but we can fund those individuals to keep evangelizing about FutureFit, to encouraging more people to come in, to identify the issues, to identify the learnings, to feed those back, to keep developing the underlying benchmark, to move into things like the city's benchmark and the country benchmark that I mentioned before that we also want to develop, keep all of that going. And the great thing is, at the end of the day, we're a nonprofit, we're a charity. So if we ever get to the hallowed stages of having more money coming in than we need, one, we can keep the fees nice and low so they don't become a barrier. And two, we can give the money away to the next bunch of nutters who want to change the world.
And again, actually, I didn't hear it until now, as we said about 3 or 4 times now, you are a charity. And, you know, for those that believe that charities are just the old-fashioned charities, that some people don't appreciate that great work they do, we have these new charities.
Absolutely. We like to say we're a not-for-profit social enterprise that has charitable status.
Yes. Perfect.
Well, that being said, you know, if any listeners got £1 million burning a hole in their pocket they don't know what to do with, please, you know, give me a call.
I was going to say that. Actually, a double golden nugget, you know, because we will have listeners that are companies or that are potentially foundations or not-for-profit companies that have a status of a charity. What was the golden nugget of your lessons in terms of, you know, being able to secure those grants? Anything that you can share? And at the same time,
That's a great question. I think that the biggest thing I've learned is, and this sort of sounds obvious, but find the grant makers whose programs you truly align with. And that sounds, you know, anybody listening to this is probably thinking, that's pretty obvious. Mm. But actually, A, it's really hard to do that a lot of the time. And B, I think foundations get peppered all the time with, well, we're almost in that category. Your stated category on the website is you're trying to fund this. Oh, we're nearly that. Or worse, that you then change your business model to chase the money.
Yeah.
And I would say never do that because it's a slippery slope. So A, stay true to your mission and keep searching for the foundations. They will exist somewhere. You just got to keep looking. And then, you know, so for us, actually the three foundations that are currently funding us, we just aligned with their programs. And then when we talked to them, we said, you know, what are you trying to achieve? This is what we're doing.
And you found them?
Yeah. There was great.
Introduce.
Absolutely. So there was some, you know, combination. And I would say try and build personal relationships if you can. Not all foundations welcome that. But certainly I found in all of those, I picked up the phone, was either introduced or sprang up and said, hey, look, this is what we're doing. Can we just talk about your program, right? And that's not sales call. It's just to help me to understand what you're looking to fund. And then I can come back to you and explain if it's how I'm aligning. And to any foundations who are listening, I think that, you know, the biggest thing I would say is if you're going to say no, please say no quickly. It's the maybes that kill you. And I absolutely won't name names, but there are a number of organizations, number of foundations who we had really protracted conversations with where the carrot was always sort of hung out there. And I'm not saying that it was deliberate, but as somebody who needs to raise that money, you're always sort of chasing after that, right? Mm-hmm. And actually, it's far kinder to just say, I'm sorry, Martin, you just don't fit. Okay, that's not the answer I want, but I would rather have that. So a quick kill or...
those doors closing and close as the, soon as
and then
as
I know,
as
and, right, and you know, you go somewhere else. Whereas, you know, if it's genuinely or potentially a positive, then that's fine. But yeah, don't string people along just to be nice to them. Get that one off my chest.
I'm not sure if we're going to have time to talk about too much about faith-based organization, but that is one thing that sometimes, you know, I pray for those closed doors.
Yeah, absolutely.
Those doors to close as soon as possible so that, you know, at least I don't waste my time and I know what to focus on.
Yeah.
Very quickly, just a little bit about you, or a little bit more in terms of, you know, we talked about a little bit about your journey, how you evolved from banking to social finance to what you're doing now. But if you want to share with us a little bit about, you know, what drives you, who inspires you today and any potential, even we'd always say the same in any person or even a book that you want to share with the listeners, what would it be? What else can we know about?
What's driving it all? You know, well, you touched on it briefly, you know, you said sort of the faith-based organizational piece. You know, so I've been a practicing Christian pretty much all my life. And one of the most exciting things I think about these last 10 years, should we say, is a sort of a dawning realization of trying to draw these different threads together in my life. And the framing of my work, my other charitable activities and the non-execs and all of that sort of stuff, my personal life, my faith, and realizing in a very similar way I was talking about, you know, how we would blend things together in a portfolio. It's kind of that same thing. The word I often use is integrity. And not just in the sense of my personal integrity. I hope I have some and there's a good thing in people. But people interpret that as meaning they tell the truth. They do what they say they're going to do. And yes, it means that. But actually, I think it's also about being integral and having an integrated life and not a siloed life. And how do all of these threads weave together? So for me, what Future Fit is doing, what I do with Access Foundation and Christian Aid and Social Investment Business and all of those things, for what drives me is a passion for four things, which is poverty, peace, progress, and people. And because I'm slightly OCD, they all begin with P. That took me a while to work that out. But those four things, peace, tackling poverty, progress, by which one might say sustainable development, and people is slavery. I hate slavery. William Wilberforce, back to, you know, somebody who is a hero of mine, William Wilberforce, the book he wrote, which has been republished. And I love the film Amazing Grace. I know it's not historically overly accurate, but it's a great inspiration. But all of those pieces, to me, act as the thread for what I say yes and no to. And when somebody says, will you get involved in this project or do this thing, then I can look at that and say, well, I see, how does that, I believe these are the things that I am passionate about. I might say, I believe God has put them on my heart. Some listeners might object to that. Doesn't matter. That's what I care about. So if somebody comes and says, you know, would you join a donkey sanctuary? Nothing against donkeys, like donkeys, but that doesn't align with those thoughts. So that gives me a framework to say, actually, I don't think that necessarily the right place for me to go. Now, maybe that would open doors to other things that would serve those purposes, maybe. But actually, that framing then helps this thread all the way through. So I don't see and try and work hard that all of these different things are not isolated silos, but I don't have a work-life balance because my work is my life. My life is my
life.
Work, you know, is life. Yeah. This is what I am doing.
It's investing.
Right. It's all of this stuff that we've been talking about. It's what I'm doing, and it's what I care about and I'm passionate about. And hopefully that's, you know, some of that will have come across in this podcast. But trying to keep evolving what that looks like, ultimately, how can I, you know, make a positive difference? How can I leave the world in a slightly better way than I found it, to end on a bit of a cliche?
Sounds all, you know, very much in line with the way that I see things as well. Mm-hmm. So, and it helps. You would think that everyone would have what I call a set of principles, you know, to help them not live life. And it helps you usually keep focus, right?
Right.
Keep working towards that one thing. Or those four things.
Yeah.
But sometimes people don't. So it's good to know how these four things drive you. And if you don't mind me asking, I mean, you mentioned that your Christianity, your beliefs, right?
Yeah.
So do you pray?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Is that
for
regular
sure.
or?
Yeah. I try to make it regular. Yeah. I think in terms of developing my personal faith journey, reading the Bible is a very important thing. It's, you know, I believe it's the word of God. So I read that on a daily basis. I pray regularly for everything that we're doing and that we're facing and for the organization and, you know, those I know in the sector. And I believe that has a positive impact. Some will agree, some won't, and that's fine. But no, yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And it's interesting because I guess that kind of it makes sense then as well to have somebody like you doing what you're doing, because you have to have a lot of hope and believe that something.
I always slightly worry, not about the having the faith, but I then sort of slightly worry that people sort of think, you know, oh, he was doing so well, and he's just a do-gooder, or, you know, it's just like some mythical voice in his head driving him. Actually, it's way deeper than that. But also, to me, this is about the purpose of why we're here and we're doing all of this. I think without an understanding of a higher purpose mm-hmm. and a reason for all of this. Yes, I do not want when I die that to be it. I don't like that as a concept because I just think it would be rather disappointing. What was the point of all of this? If we really are just here by confluence of physics as a result of a Big Bang, and I say I do believe in the Big Bang, I'm not a creationist, but you know, if this is all there is, that for me is a really disappointing outcome. And why would I then not actually just live a life that really was focused in on me? Because if there's no greater purpose, there's no eternal consequence, there's no just a physical end, there's no end to the result, then what's the point? And so actually for me, it's more about that. Actually, there is an eternal purpose. There is a reason for all of this, and which we don't see today, that actually makes me think there is relevance, consequence, importance to what we are doing. We were designed to be here. We were designed to be here now at this point in time with a purpose. And actually life should be about discovering that purpose and in our relationship with what we would call God.
Yeah. What some people call a call.
Yes, right? Absolutely. So, absolutely.
And then we go through that journey trying to find what is that call and how we can actually help others and each other, you know?
Yeah.
So I think that is very powerful.
And
it's one of the reasons why we're here today and why we're doing the podcast.
Absolutely. And, you know, but it's a fascinating area. My co-founder, Jeff, is an atheist. You know, so you don't have to be like to do this stuff.
Like Ricky Gervais.
Right.
Thank you, God, for making me an atheist.
Exactly. You know, so, and we have some great debates therefore around. So it's, again, it's like, I'm not saying that you can't come to these issues from different perspectives and have different drivers behind what you're doing. That's one area of life that he and I don't agree on. You know, we do agree on other things like supporting Liverpool Football Club. But yeah, you know, for me, that is the underlying thread that's driving all of this.
Liverpool, who are going to be the champions this year.
Well, you know, we probably shouldn't say that in case there are I don't want to tempt fate. Not that we believe in fate, but, you know, top of the league again at the moment. What can we say? Fingers crossed.
Okay. So thank you. Thank you so much for sharing
that
with
us.
And if I asked you just that, well, we're coming to the end of the podcast, do you have any particular mentors or anyone that helped you along the line?
So I've had a couple of individual mentors along the way, and I don't actually have one at the moment. I was very fortunate for a little while. I had Lord Paul Boateng as a mentor, which was amazing because he was so completely opposite to me in so many ways, which just made him a brilliant mentor. The one thing funnily enough, we shared was faith. But, you know, he's from a different continent, a different background. He's a lawyer. I am an engineer. He was on the Labour benches. I more naturally would lean the other way. I'm not going to go into politics right now. I don't think I'd lean anyway right now. But, you know, there was so much in our lives which were different, which just made him superb as a mentor. Because I think in that you want people who are different. What's the point of having an echo chamber? Mm-hmm. I don't want a mentor who says, hey, Martin, you're amazing. This is great. Oh, I totally agree. Everything you say is right. What do you learn? You know, I want somebody who says, actually, I think that's complete rubbish. And this is the way it is. That's how you learn and you grow and you stretch. So I've been fortunate to have one or two folks like that. Right now, I'm in the market for a mentor, actually.
Okay. Okay. There you go. If you listen.
Yeah.
One little ask.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely.
And do you mentor anyone?
I do. I see. Yes. Yeah. One or two folks that I've just known along the way. And also I sort of seem to have ended up being a bit of one of those individuals, particularly for people looking to get into the impact space. So I get the opportunity to talk to a lot of people at different stages of their career, not on a mentoring basis, just on a one-on-one basis, which I just love. I think it's such a privilege to be able to meet people at a point in their journey. And not tell them where to go, but just to show them some of the doorways and say, if you thought about this, what is it you're trying to do? And get the opportunity, you know, for a coffee for an hour, just to sort of poke their thinking a little bit and hopefully send them away with some fresh thinking. Which I love, you know, it's quite a time consuming thing, but it's a great privilege to do.
Yeah.
But yeah, I love the mentoring I do, I really love.
And through all these years and your careers and the people you have met, you know, you must have met a few leaders or impact leaders in this case. What did you observe is one of the attributes or characteristics that you would flag?
Oh, gosh, there's a question. The really good leaders are the ones who they have the determination and the passion and the drive to make things happen, but they somehow manage to avoid bludgeoning people over the head with it.
Mm-hmm.
And I think the really great leaders are those who sort of do lead from behind and somehow manage to convey their thought processes into everybody else so that they think it was their idea. So they go and do it. And the leader is just there behind shepherding and guiding and helping. And I think sort of that approach over a kind of just a barracking of people, that can work for a while, but it actually gets very tiring. And people eventually get sort of a bit bored of that and wander off. So absolutely, I've had the privilege of being up close and personal to a number of these folks and just observing how they interact with people, how they show their vision, and they excite people about where the world could be and how people can play a role in being part of that. And I think, if anything, perhaps the biggest thing I've tried to mimic is that piece about empowering people. And in any talk that I'm giving, in a keynote or part of a group in a seminar or something, is I want people to leave that conversation feeling slightly changed, slightly empowered to go and do something. It's the equivalent of the brochure sat on the shelf collecting dust, right? I don't want people to say, oh, that was a nice conversation. Oh, well, well done you, well said. I want people to be leaving a room saying, I'm going to make a difference. I'm going to change something. A little anecdote on that, if I may. Last year, I was speaking at a festival in the summer, an event called New Wine. And I'd been talking a bit about personal journey and these various sort of guidelines that I use personally in encouraging people to think about what their own would be. And at the end, it's often the way as I got a little bit mobbed as you come off the stage, half a dozen people come up and have a chat. My wife was in the room and she overheard a conversation between two quite elderly ladies walking out. And she said they were both like well in their 80s. And she said she just heard one say to the other, he's right, I don't care how old I am. I'm going to go and make a difference. And that was all she heard. I just thought, fantastic. Isn't that amazing? Brilliant. Even if it wasn't like, I'm too old to do anything. I'm going to go make a difference. And I think whenever we're talking or presenting, if we can help people to leave the room feeling, I can go and do that. I can make a difference in that way. I'm going to go back to my desk on Monday morning. I'm going to look at the FutureFit website, or I'm going to join B Corp, or I'm just going to go and volunteer at my local, whatever it might be. Well, it doesn't matter. If we can empower people to make that difference, I think, when I look at those great leaders who inspire me, I think that's perhaps what I get out of them and I try to live up to.
I was going to ask you, what would be your call to action for those 80-year-old women to the podcast?
You can be future fit even when you're 80. Absolutely. The call to action would be very self-serving here, but would obviously be, please go to the Future Fit website, futurefitbusiness.org. Check out all the materials there. But you know what, even if that isn't where you are right now or appropriate for where you are, start to think about how all of these pieces are connected. The fact they're listening to your podcast, JP, they're already beginning to think around this. What are the things in your life that drive you? What does that mean to integrate the different parts of your life? Are you living in a way? Are you working in a way? Are you doing community in a way that actually reflects whatever your personal values might be? Maybe there's just one little thing in there that you might want to change.
Great. And the wonderful thing, if I may say something, is that the wonderful thing about Future Fit is impact leaders at the podcast tends to have a lot of kind of investors or investor focus people being interviewed. But I think the ultimate, I always try to repeat, while we're doing this, the ultimate goal is to start with just generate awareness and spread
the news,
the world of impact investing, so that everyone changes from behavior as individuals all the way to the top, so we can deploy the capital into those companies that serve us all.
Right.
And Future Fit is applicable to everyone in the supply chain.
Yes.
So if anyone wants to contact you, what is your preferred method normally?
So email's a great way. The access through the website is info@futurefitbusiness.org. If you fire an email down that, just say, I heard your chat, ask a question.
And you use LinkedIn or Twitter?
I'm on LinkedIn. My only thing with LinkedIn is I do want to know you personally.
Okay.
So if you reach out randomly to me on LinkedIn, you probably won't get accepted. If you reach out and say, hey, let's get a coffee and meet in person, then I'm very happy to do that.
Wow. That's quite an invitation.
A bit of a power user of LinkedIn, but I like to know the folks.
Yeah, no wonder.
That's the idea in my book.
If you have the time, yeah. No? Fantastic.
But I like good coffee, just as an advance warning. Okay, so it's got to be a decent cup of coffee.
Fantastic, brilliant. Thank you so much, Martin.
JP, it's been a pleasure. Thank you. Really enjoyed it. And hopefully, have I got the record for rambling on the longest? I think I might be getting close.
I think we may.
Wow. Sorry, Andrew.
No, but thank you. Thank you so much. Until next time.
Pleasure. Look forward to it. Take care.
So bye for now to everyone listening to today's episode. And until the next time we listen to Impact Leaders, please remember to check our partners' websites for our coming events and do get in touch if you have any questions. Thank you so much. Until next one.
This was Impact Leaders. Impact Leaders is brought to you by Fast Forward 2030 and Real Changers. Visit fastforward2030.com to learn how to include the global goals into your business models, and realchangers.com to find talent and careers with impact.